listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
On behalf of the Secretary General, I will devote my regular briefing on the situation in the Middle East today to presenting the 9th report on the implementation of Security Council Resolution 2334.
That was the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Nikolai Mladenov, at the UN Security Council in New York Tuesday, delivering an updated report on the situation around Gaza within the context of the most recent hostilities over the past few days.
In the past 10 days, there have been 2 rocket attacks from Gaza targeting the Tel Aviv area. They represent a very serious escalation. Since the early hours of yesterday, my team and I have been working intensely with Egypt and all concerned parties to ensure that the situation does not spiral out of control. As I have said many times in this council, but I will repeat it here today again, nobody has an interest in a full military confrontation in Gaza. A new conflict will be devastating for the Palestinian people. It will have consequences for Israelis who live in the vicinity of the Gaza perimeter, and it is likely to have regional repercussions. This is why I ask you all today to join the United Nations in condemning the continued indiscriminate firing of rockets towards Israel. Such acts of provocation only dramatically increase the risk of escalation and ultimately damage our collective efforts to support the people of Gaza and intra-Palestinian reconciliation. We must also call on all sides to exercise maximum restraint as the situation remains extremely tense. Mr. President, returning to the report under Resolution 2334, I have to begin by saying that once again no steps have been taken by Israel to, I quote, immediately and completely cease all settlement activity in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, end quote, as called for by Security Council Resolution 2334. Since the end of the reporting period, the government has announced the construction of another 840 new units in Ariel. This decision was presented as a response to the attack to an attack on the 17th of March. Demonstrations and seizures of Palestinian-owned structures also continued across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Since the 15th of March, an additional 7 Palestinian-owned structures were demolished or seized by Israeli authorities. This has resulted in the displacement of 9 people, a water cistern in Susia, 3 structures belonging to communities in southern Hebron, and an elementary school building under construction, the Shofat refugee camp in East Jerusalem, are among the buildings demolished. Mr. President, Security Council Resolution 2334 also calls for, I quote, immediate steps to prevent all acts of violence against civilians. However, even the brief period since the submission of this report, as witnessed by recent events, has been characterized by escalating violence. Beginning on 14th and 15th of March, thousands of Palestinians in Gaza demonstrated under the slogan, "We want to live." They protested the dire socioeconomic circumstances in Gaza and, I quote, the injustices due to the Palestinian division and Hamas's takeover of Gaza by force and violence, end quote. Although the protests were generally non-violent, Hamas security personnel violently dispersed participants and many, including women, children, journalists and human rights activists, were beaten or hospitalized. Tens of homes were raided in search of demonstrators. Local human rights monitors reported that over 1,000 people, including children, were arrested, with many reportedly beaten. The crackdown was condemned by all Palestinian factions. Meanwhile, protests at the Gaza fence, which had subsided for a couple of days, also resumed. At least 11 incendiary devices were launched from Gaza towards Israel since the 15th of March only. In response, the IDF shelled and conducted airstrikes against targets in Gaza on 4 occasions, causing no injuries. This, of course, does not include the rockets fired in the escalation of the last 48 hours. Mr. President, tensions in the occupied West Bank also continued. 4 Palestinians were killed by Israeli security forces and in various security operations and other incidents, while 2 Israelis, including 1 soldier and 1 civilian, were killed by Palestinians. On the 17th of March, a Palestinian stabbed an Israeli soldier near the Ariel settlement, took his rifle and shot him and an Israeli civilian, killing both and severely injuring another soldier. In the subsequent search operations, 15 homes were raided, a temporary security cordon was imposed on several villages, and three of the suspect's family members were arrested. 2 days later, the suspect was also killed by the ISF in the village of Abwein. Another incident took place on the 19th of March, when Jewish worshippers, accompanied by Israeli security forces, entered Nablus on their way to visit Joseph's tomb, a monthly practice that is consistent with previous agreements between the parties. While the details of the ensuing clashes remain disputed, 2 Palestinians were killed by the ISF and at least 27 others have been injured. In Bethlehem, on the 20th of March, a 26-year-old Palestinian was shot and killed by the ISF and another was injured while driving near a partial military checkpoint under disputed circumstances. In Beit Sira, a village near Ramallah, a Palestinian man was similarly shot and injured near a checkpoint. Israeli authorities have launched investigations into both events. On the 24th of March, 2 Israeli prison guards apparently were stabbed by Hamas inmates in the Kidziot prison in southern Israel. Following this, 12 prisoners were reportedly injured in ensuing clashes between guards and inmates. Mr. President, Security Council Resolution 2334 calls upon the parties to, I quote, refrain from provocative actions, incitement, and inflammatory rhetoric. Unfortunately, such action and rhetoric has continued. On March 17th, both Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad praised the attack near the settlement of Ariel and called it a heroic operation, while Fatah social media pages praised the operator as a heroic martyr. Israeli political leaders have also continued to call for targeted assassinations of Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad officials, and for the annexation of the West Bank. Mr. President, Resolution 2334 reiterated calls by the Middle East Quartet for affirmative steps to be taken immediately to reverse negative trends on the ground that are imperiling the two-state solution. No such steps have been taken during the reporting period. Meanwhile, the situation in Jerusalem's holy sites continues to be tense. On the 17th of March, The Jerusalem Magistrate Court reinstated for 60 days an order to close the building located at the Bab al-Rahma, or also known as Mercy Gate, in the Haram al-Sharif Temple Mount compound, which has been closed by the Israeli Authority since 2003 on security grounds. The Islamic Endowment, the Waqf, echoed by Palestinian and Jordanian ministries of foreign affairs, maintains clearly that the Israeli courts lack jurisdiction over the holy site, which lies in the territory occupied in 1967, and warned against any changes to the historic and legal status quo. Israel, however, considers the establishment of a mosque at the Mercy Gate a violation of the status quo. As of the 20th of March, the Jerusalem Magistrate Court order has not been executed. Daily prayers continue at the Mercy Gate area while discussions between Israel and Jordan are ongoing. Mr. President, the past few days have not also seen a resolution to the funding crisis created by Israel's decision to withhold 6% of revenue it collects on behalf of the PA and the Palestinian leadership's refusal to accept any clearance transfers unless the full amount is reinstated. The Palestinian government has begun implementing extremely severe austerity measures. These measures include a 50% salary cut for over 50% of Palestinian government employees, an overall ceiling on salary payments, cessation of promotions, appointments and bonuses, purchase of property and cars, and a 20% reduction in operational expenses across the board, including reduced expenses on travel and fuel. In addition, the Palestinian Authority plans to borrow from domestic banks between now and the month of July. This will, however, all have a very substantial impact on the Palestinian economy, resulting in reduced purchasing power and further reduction in the GDP growth, both in the West Bank and Gaza. Mr. President, in closing, I would like to reiterate some of the observations concerning the implementation of the provisions of Resolution 2334. The expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, including Jerusalem, is continuing unabated. The advancement, approval, or tender of more than 3,000 units in the occupied West Bank, which is reported in the written report which you have received, is the largest batch since May 2018. This includes the latest announcements of over 800 units in the settlement of Ariel. I reiterate that the establishment of settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, has no legal effect and constitutes a flagrant violation of international law, as stated in Resolution 2334. It must cease immediately and completely. The demolition and seizure of Palestinian structures also continues. The demolition of structures linked to vital water connections in Area C of the West Bank communities, already suffering from water shortages, is particularly troubling. I'm concerned by the continued pressure being placed on Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Such policies must be reversed, and Israel should abide by its obligations under international law. I'm saddened by the persistent violence that continues to result in the tragic loss of Palestinian and Israeli lives. Recent incidents in the West Bank and Gaza highlight the mounting tensions across the occupied Palestinian territory and the risk of a broader escalation of the conflict. I call on the parties to reject violence and to work to reduce tensions. There is no justification for terror, and I call on all to join the United Nations in condemning it unequivocally. I am concerned that we may once again be facing another very dangerous escalation of violence in Gaza, with potentially catastrophic consequences. The last 2 days have shown how precariously close we came to the brink of war once again. The indiscriminate launching of rockets and mortars against towns and villages violates international law and places civilian lives at great risk. The launching of incendiary and explosive devices towards Israel must also stop. I remain gravely concerned by the number of deaths and injuries of Palestinians along the Gaza perimeter fence as well. Israeli security forces have the responsibility to exercise restraint, and lethal force must be used only when strictly avoidable in order to protect life. I strongly condemn the campaign of arrests and violence inside Gaza against protesters, including women and children. The brutal beating of journalists, human rights workers, and the raiding of homes is particularly alarming. The long-suffering people of Gaza have a right to protest without fear of reprisal, and I call on all member states to join the United Nations in condemning such acts. As I have repeatedly emphasized, the situation in Gaza is untenable, and the latest protests further highlight the need for the return of a unified Palestinian government to Gaza. I call on all Palestinian factions to engage in earnest with Egypt in order to implement the 2017 Cairo Agreement and end internal divisions. While the United Nations is continuing its efforts to de-escalate the situation, progress on the reconciliation track and the lifting of closures on Gaza remains essential. I encourage member states to support these vital efforts. The lack of resolution of the PA's funding crisis threatens to further destabilize an already volatile situation. Both parties should continue to implement their bilateral agreements and avoid taking unilateral actions that undermine the two-state solution. The situation in the Old City of Jerusalem, Mr. President, remains also a serious concern. I urge all parties to work towards de-escalating tensions. I encourage Israel and Jordan to work together to uphold the status quo at the holy sites, noting the special and historic role of the Hashemite Kingdom as custodian of the Muslim and Christian holy sites in Jerusalem. Lastly, I remain deeply concerned by the lack of progress towards the realization of a two-state solution in line with relevant UN resolutions, long-standing international parameters, and prior agreements. There is no viable alternative to the two-state solution. Given the interconnected nature of conflicts throughout the region and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict's potential to fuel extremist narratives, creating the conditions for the parties to return to meaningful negotiations remains critical. What is needed, however, first and foremost, is the necessary leadership and political will to take concrete steps in support of ending the occupation and realizing a lasting peace. Until that can be found, another generation of Israelis and Palestinians is destined to spend their lives searching in vain for an elusive peace. Thank you.
That was the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Nikolai Mladenov, at the UN Security Council on Tuesday in New York. Mladenov is a former defense minister for Bulgaria. He was appointed to his position by the former Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and regularly reports on the conditions around Gaza. There was a report Wednesday that Syria has called for an emergency meeting of the Security Council to discuss President Trump's announced recognition of the annexation of Syria's Golan Heights by Israel, which has occupied Golan Heights since 1967. RT's Igor Zhdanov has more on that.
Well, the international community has been somewhat pushed under the bus by this whole decision. The most vocal in this have been, of course, the Arab countries. The whole of Arab League made public a joint statement condemning the decision. Really standing out, a condemnation by Saudi Arabia, for instance, you know, Washington's bestie in the Gulf. So it kind of tells the scale of the fallout this Trump's decision has had. Turkey also has condemned the move. Russia voiced its concerns in regards to the stability of the Middle East because Moscow believes that such a decision by Trump really undermines that. Also, Syria, of course, it's their territories. That's how international community, that's how the UN sees the Golan Heights as a Syrian territories. The Golan Heights is a strip of land on the border between Syria and Israel. Back in the 80s, in the course of a war, it was occupied by Israel. And that is how it is classified internationally. That's how UN puts it, that it is a Syrian territory occupied by Israel. Now, not the entirety of the Golan Heights is de facto under the control of Israel. There's a small portion of it that is still under Damascus's control. And I was lucky enough to visit that part back last year, back in 2018. And really, it was something of a turnaround moment, I think, for that part of the Golan Heights. Because when I went there, it was mere weeks after the Syrian army and the Russian jets liberated that area from the control of ISIL. There were certain pockets of Islamic State there, like Al-Qaritain, for instance. I go out on a limb and say that I can name one person who's particularly happened that things are shaping out as they are, and that is the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, because he's facing elections in a couple of weeks. And in the run-up to these elections, he's been embroiled in a massive, nasty corruption scandal. Now that he's thrown a bone to all those in Israel sharing the nationalist tension, he not only has Jerusalem recognized by the United States as the capital of Israel, but also he now has the Golan Heights.
Meanwhile, on Tuesday, the State Department's deputy spokesperson, Robert Palladino, answered questions about both Gaza and the Golan Heights.
Syria still, Robert? In Syria?
Syria.
Very quick.
Okay, go ahead.
Today, the Secretary of State issued a statement on the 40th anniversary of the Egypt-Israel Camp David Accord, the peace treaty, which was premised on Resolution 242 and the principle of land for peace. So I guess now there is no land to sort of trade between Syria and Israel. Is that the case? Do you consider 242 to have been fulfilled, null and void? What is your take on that?
Yeah, well, the decision that the president announced was a critical strategic and of security importance to the state of Israel and to stability of the Middle East. So, you know, to allow the Golan Heights to be controlled by the likes of Syrian and Iranian regimes would be to turn a blind eye to threats emanating from a Syrian regime that engages in atrocities, and from Iran and terrorist actors, including Hezbollah, that would seek to use the Golan Heights as a launching ground for attacks against Israel.
I understand all that, but the principle of land for peace.
Well, hold on. Just sorry. So you might understand it. I don't understand it at all. Was there some threat that Iran and Syria were actually going to control the Golan Heights?
Without,
if there was, I missed it.
There have been many efforts.
Not to control it, though.
But a lack of Israel's ability to defend that area would be to undermine Israeli security and enhancing the Golan Heights is to enhance Israel's security, and which strengthens, frankly, our ability to partner with Israel to fight the common threats that we face.
You know, I don't understand. What is different 3 days ago about Israel's ability to defend the Golan than what is different today than it was 3 days ago? And you talk about this regional stability, but every single country in the region, except for Israel, every single one of them, all of Syria and Israel's neighbors have come out against this and say it's bad for stability. So this is a case where you and Israel are right and everyone else, including the neighbors, are wrong?
Not a popularity contest.
Well, that's good.
Standing up for what is right oftentimes is not. This is something that the president has been considering for some time. As he made clear, the statement on the Golan Heights reflects our understanding of the unique circumstances that makes it appropriate to recognize Israeli sovereignty
But is it your position that Israel's control of the Golan without this announcement by the president would have been somehow threatened, or that it was in jeopardy? That
it was a recognition of reality. That the president would move forward on this position.
And do you think that it will change Iran's efforts or Syria's efforts to infiltrate terrorists or fighters into the Golan simply because there's a U.S. president has signed a proclamation saying that it's recognizing Israel's sovereignty?
Certainly makes things clear. Israel's security is something that, of course, they're going to continue to defend and something that we're going to continue to support.
And this administration has made it clear, as have previous administrations, but this one has made it clear, let's say, with Gaza, with border with Lebanon, and that the land that Israel has there is Israeli sovereign territory. And that hasn't stopped Hamas or Hezbollah from either launching attacks. So I'm just curious as to why you think that the proclamation actually changes conditions on the ground to the point where that some kind of threat to Israel's control over it is now done.
We're not saying the threat is over in any ways. The threat, of course, continues. And Israel's need, our need to help support continues, of course. That affects all of stabilization.
Yeah, I just want to finish my question, if I may. To be clear, do you consider 242 to be null and void, completely fulfilled, There is no land to trade since, you know, the whole premise of that is land for peace. So that land is no longer, as far as you're concerned, is no longer Syrian, correct? So 242, is it null and void? Is it, and 338, as a matter of fact, the other UN resolution, is it considered fulfilled, null and void? What is your designation to the resolution 242 and 338?
The administration has made clear that it supports negotiation towards a comprehensive peace between Israel and its neighbors.
Including Syria?
This administration, unlike previous administrations, is willing to acknowledge the reality that there can be no comprehensive peace agreement that does not satisfactorily address Israel's security needs in the Golan Heights. This is an area that is vital to Israel's national security.
Gaza, real quick on Gaza. I just want, things are heating up again, and the Israelis now are saying that, you know, a ceasefire can only be implemented if it's somehow conditioned on ending the demonstrations that take place every Friday in Gaza. Do you agree with that premise? Do you agree with that principle that they ought to be tied to the ceasefire and ending the demonstration?
We condemn the rocket attacks from Gaza into Israel. It's important to say this. We condemn the rocket attacks from Gaza into Israel, and we strongly support Israel's right to defend itself. The attacks are outrageous and unacceptable.
So
our position is there must be a complete and permanent halt. We welcome efforts by regional allies that are seeking to restore calm and prevent further attacks. And
that's,
I have
all excellent,
nothing
but
further
is,
on that.
Is it, should it be tied to the demonstrations and ending the demonstrations?
We welcome efforts by regional allies that are seeking to restore calm and prevent attacks.
This coming weekend, we'll see a kickoff of the season of anti-war protests in the U.S. in Washington, D.C. The first group of actions begins March 30th and will continue to April 4th, the anniversary of the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Official Washington, however, will be throwing a big party on that date to celebrate the formation of NATO. Netva Freeman with the Black Alliance for Peace spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
We're part of the No Foreign Bases Coalition and a whole host of organizations that are mobilizing on March 30th to oppose NATO. The United States government and the Western allies have chosen this time to commemorate the anniversary of the 70th anniversary of NATO, which is actually on April 4th. And so people are mobilizing to stand against this or make an expression against war and imperialism and the increasing militarization, U.S. militarization of the world. And also on April 4th, which is the actual anniversary of NATO, it's also the memorial for the 50th memorial of Dr. King's assassination. And so this is, we are seeing this as a grotesque desecration of the legacy of Dr. King, of someone who stood as opposed to war and militarism and capitalism and imperialism and those things. And so we are also, on that date is the celebration of NATO that will take place at the State Department. And we're mobilizing to have an action during the day to demonstrate, protest this celebration. And then in the evening, we're having a forum at Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C., which we are actually honored that you'll be a guest keynote speaker and a number of other speakers. During that event in the evening from 7 to 9 p.m., we're going to have the event No Compromise, No Retreat in the Fight to End Militarism and War. It will be emceed by Jeriba Hill of the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights. And we'll also have speaking Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report, Vanessa Beck, who's on the Coordinated Committee of Black Alliance for Peace, then G.W. McHarris from Movement for Black Lives, Dr. Rose Brewer from Black Alliance for Peace, and who's also a scholar activist out of Minnesota, and Gina Betts, who's the mother of India Kager, whose daughter, India Kager, was murdered by police. So, and then myself will be on the panel. This is when we're going to also launch the domestic side of the Black Alliances for Peace, a campaign. So we have first the Shutdown AFRICOM U.S. out of Africa, but also we know that the U.S. militarization is extending into our communities inside the United States with the militarization of the police, and also just a war against African people that's more than just the police, that goes into the mass incarceration, the persecution and continued persecution of our political prisoners, and even the collaboration with Israel in repressing our communities right here. The police actually train together and figure out ways to continue the occupations in the respective countries.
In addition to protesting the NATO celebration held on the assassination date of Dr. Martin Luther King, you're also demanding that the Congressional Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus oppose Donald Trump's economic sanctions against Venezuela and his threats of military intervention.
Yeah, because obviously, so one, people are really need to understand that the nature of imperialism right now is in a stage where they're really trying to increase the domination of the world with a shrinking economy, and they're also losing their place as a world power. And Donald Trump's administration seems to be shifting its focus to this hemisphere, stepping up an enforcement of the Monroe Doctrine and that legacy. And so we know that any military actions and also the sanctions against Venezuela or any place disproportionately affect our people. And just the fact that they're inhumane anyway, no matter who they affect, we should be opposed to those things. And so Afro-Venezuelans have made a pronouncement that says they don't want war, but they're preparing for it. They're ready for it. They want to prepare for it. And they're asking us. And it's not just because they're asking us, because this is our principal position, is to stand against the sanctions and against any threat or military intervention in that country or any place in the world anyway. And so we've called for that. And the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, we're working along with them, who've put out a petition that's calling for the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Progressive Caucus to support the bill H.R. 1004, which prohibits the unauthorized military action in Venezuela and also an end to the sanctions.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Russiagate, the two-year circus or nightmare, take your pick, is seemingly settled. Trump says he's been exonerated, but the political left and much of the media do not concur. Where do we go from here? And will the investigators be investigated? Crosstalking the Mueller Report, I'm joined by my guest, Doug Weed in Washington. He's a presidential historian and a former White House advisor to two American presidents. Also in Washington, we have William Beeney. He is a former technical director at NSA. And in Miami, we cross to Alan Dershowitz. He's a professor emeritus at Harvard Law School, as well as author of the book, The Case Against the Democratic House Impeaching Trump. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Alan Dershowitz first in Miami. Alan Dershowitz, you and I probably couldn't agree on anything, on policies, on politics. You're a man from the left. I am not. But you are the only person on the left that came through this unscathed, and I would even say enhanced. So I appreciate your work in discussing this. My first question is here, Mueller's report, Donald Trump says, exonerates him. Maybe so. But for me, it is a searing indictment of the FBI and how the FBI conducted itself and how we got to having to have such a special report and end up with the results that we did. What was the crime? It seems like there was a conspiracy without a crime. Go ahead, Alan Dershowitz in Miami.
Well, most FBI agents are wonderful. They devote their lives to protecting us, and I have only the highest regard for the typical FBI agent on the street. There was a problem here of a leadership, and there were people in the FBI who were determined to make sure that President Trump was not elected president, even if he got more electoral votes than the other side. And so I think we do have a problem, and I think the new director of the FBI, the new attorney general, their first task is to look inside and try to clean up and see what went wrong. Look, there's a lot of blame to go around. President Trump deserves some of the blame. When he fired Comey, he essentially invited the appointment of a special counsel. I think it was a mistake to appoint a special counsel because there was no evidence of crime, and a special counsel shouldn't be appointed unless there is very considerable evidence of crime at the very top. But the firing was inept in the sense that it would have been great to fire him on day one because everybody wanted Comey fired on day one as a result of what he had done in the Hillary Clinton investigation. But firing him in the middle of an investigation provoked people like Rosenstein to seek the appointment of a special counsel. But the special counsel has not proved to be a worthwhile task. No Americans have been indicted in relation to any alleged collusion with Russia. All the indictments fall into categories that are outside of that. And so I think the Mueller report in the end, even on the Russian collusion, even though it came out the right way, has not justified what it's done. And then on the issue of obstruction of justice, Mueller just punted. He just refused to decide. And that wasn't what his job was. He should have decided one way or the other.
That wasn't what his job was. I guess I didn't hear that on CNN or MSNBC. Later in the program, we'll talk about the media and its culpability here. Let me go to Doug. Doug, I mean, when do we start the second half of the investigation, maybe under another special investigation? Because from what I understand, what Mueller gave to the Attorney General Barr is only half the story. When do we, and should we, and will we look at exactly some of the issues that Alan Dershowitz mentioned, the upper levels of the FBI and members of the general in the DOJ? They still have a lot to account for. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, well, interesting, Peter. The very fact that you asked that question leads me to believe that we're headed that way. There's just too much curiosity and momentum now carrying this. People are going to want to know. This is kind of a unique moment in history from the antiquities through the Middle Ages, even into modern times. Very often we'll find that the winner will prosecute the loser, even in Latin America right now. That's happened twice, maybe three times in Brazil. It's happened in Argentina. It's happened in Peru. It happens in a way in France, not the heads of state, but the donors and the judges and the media people. So here we had an example of the loser prosecuting the winner. That was interesting to me. And what stunned me, no indictments, that stunned me. I mean, Stalin famously said, show me the man, I'll show you the crime. In the 17th century, Cardinal Richelieu said, give me nine lines written by any man, I can have him hung as a criminal.
I have to correct you. It was Beria that said that, but we get the point, okay? the same implications.
Oh, thank you.
You know, William, your involvement
but he said
in
it
this.
To Stalin.
Yeah, said it to Stalin. Okay, Alan Dershowitz backs me up on that. William, you're a forensic expert here, and you in the Veeps group, have done a thorough investigation and research into this. I'm sure the Mueller, other people contacted you and wanted to know what you thought about all of this hacking. But they didn't, did they? Go ahead, William.
No, they didn't. In fact, we were prepared to testify in front of any of the committees, also Mueller's group. None of them wanted to know about the forensics. It was very clear to us the forensics proved that the data from the DNC was downloaded to a storage device and transported for some distance prior to WikiLeaks putting it on the web. Other material that WikiLeaks put out didn't show the transfer of data to storage, but the DNC data did show that. So it was a very clearly someone who was very close to the data who copied it down to a thumb drive or a CD-ROM of some sort and then transported it for some period of distance. Okay. But other than that, there's another really major problem here with this whole episode of Russiagate, and it has to do with the use of intelligence agencies against political parties and against individuals in the country. This is another violation. This is something that Nixon was guilty of. So he was impeached. Now, these are the felonies that are occurring at this level, and we need to get deep into this, find out who was involved.
Yeah, but interesting.
and then go after them.
It's actually worse, William, because the FBI and the DOJ at the end of the day pushed back against Nixon. We remember that very, very well. Now we have something that's very different. Alan Dershowitz, again, we go back to the You're origins right. of the dossier and defrauding the FISA court. I mean, these are very, very serious things. I mean, what Paul Manafort did is wrong, and I don't feel particularly sorry for him. But, you know, did Roger Stone need to have a military virtual attack on his home at dawn? I mean, the lack of balance here. And I want to go back to the dossier and the FISA. I hope that this is going to be revisited, because if any one of us on this program did something like that, we'd be looking at a felony conviction and time in prison. Go ahead, Alan Dershowitz.
Well, no, I completely agree. I think the FISA court was defrauded. That is, you can show information to the FISA court which isn't particularly compelling, as long as you tell the court what the source is and alert it to the weaknesses and the conflicts of interest. But you cannot provide material to the court claiming it's credible when you yourself know that it lacks credibility. Particularly the FISA court operates ex parte. They don't hear two sides. They only hear one side. So they trust the government officials to present the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And the government officials who presented the application for the FISA warrant failed that test. And I think there ought to be considerations of contempt of court proceedings initiated by the FISA court against those who may well have misled them.
You know, Doug, we still have Rod Rosenstein in the DOJ. He signed off on the fourth FISA warrant. And I thought it was very interesting, under oath, he was asked repeatedly, did you read it? He was very evasive. He would never say if he actually read it. He didn't deny signing it, but he didn't really answer the question if he'd read it. And I mean, and he's still in a place of power, probably not for much longer, but he's a witness in all this. Again, I don't see these people, the Peter Strzoks, the Lisa Pages, Bruce Orr. I mean, I don't think they're done yet, or at least they shouldn't be done with a prosecutor be asking questions. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that's where we're headed, and it's going to be very interesting and very colorful. I'm surprised at how much restraint Donald Trump has shown throughout this process. I find that fascinating. You don't normally associate restraint with Donald Trump, but his patience has paid off. I once had a conversation with Jared Kushner about all of this, and he said with a little wry smile, he said, you know, I told my father-in-law, the Russian collusion, it's one time that you are definitely, definitely innocent. So I found it worked to his favor. In a way, they feel it distracted people from all of the controversy that would have come over the deregulations and the other issues that the media could have played on.
You know, William, do you think it would be wise for President Trump to release all of these documents? Redactions would be necessary. But do you think that, you know, we need a document dump for the public to understand everything that has happened? I mean, you've done your side of the research and investigation on the forensic side here. But I think it's about time the American people should be able to judge what makes sense and what doesn't, because we're going to talk in the second part of the program about how the media is culpable in all this. Go ahead, William.
Yeah, I agree. And also, I think all the documents going to the FISA court should be declassified and released also. And another point I make out is the FISA court has known that the government's been lying to them all along. They've known this for decades. The earliest reports on lying by the FBI to the FISA court were in the summer of 2002, where the FISA court discovered they had lied to them in at least 75 warrant requests. Now, this is nothing new. These people have known they've been lied to all along. What are these judges going to wake up? If they can't wake up, I think we should dissolve that Article 2 court, that I call it, and revert everything to Article 3 courts.
Okay, well, that's a very good point, and this episode might move us in that direction here. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Mueller report. Stay with our team.
You're listening to Weekday World
from CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Alan Dershowitz in Miami. Alan Dershowitz, did you miss all those parties at Martha's Vineyard? Because I heard you said that you weren't invited to them because of your political stance here. If that's what you want to return to, I hope the best. You also said that you were banned from CNN because you, well, I'll use my own words, didn't say the right things. What does that tell us about how the media played its role in all this huge, huge fiasco, which I think its consequences are still barely even conceived here? Go ahead, Alan, in Miami.
Well, I think CNN misled and really defrauded its listeners. You know, for months and months in the beginning, I was on debating Jeffrey Toobin. Yep. I was on with Lemon, with Anderson Cooper, with Cuomo. And I was the only liberal Democrat who was saying, wait a minute, the evidence isn't here. The Constitution protects the president's yep. right to punish. They didn't want to hear that on the air. It was okay to hear extreme right-wing Republicans defend Trump down the line and extreme people on the left attack him. But they didn't want a centrist, thoughtful, liberal Democrat telling their viewers that this is complicated and this is difficult. So for the last 8 months, they've banned me from their air. And it turns out then that the viewers just got a misguided view. They were shocked at the outcome because they had been assured by their pundits that there was going to be indictments, impeachments, you name it. But the people who heard diverse points of view on other channels weren't as surprised. So CNN really owes an apology to its listeners and to, you know, the American public.
But Doug, CNN and MSNBC, they will never apologize. I mean, even after the findings of the report were made public, you have like Clapper and Brennan just kind of, you know, just squealing away. You know, well, I didn't get the best information. But I mean, it was so patently stupid. I mean, they made complete fools out of themselves. But they're not going to lose their jobs, are they? Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, very, very interesting. The media in some cases reminds me of a cartoon character that keeps getting bashed. I mean, they were wrong about the election and they were wrong in the extreme. For example, that last ABC Washington Post poll gave the Democrats 11-point advantage. They had more African-Americans voting for Hillary Clinton than voted for Barack Obama in the previous election. Somehow, I would think that wouldn't likely to happen. And then in the last minute, they wouldn't, CNN wouldn't call Pennsylvania when there were actually not enough votes left if every one of them went to Hillary Clinton for her to reverse the trend and take the state. Once again, I invoke Jared Kushner because he just fascinates me. I asked him if he thought there was a conspiracy or what's behind the media on this. He was much too sensible to take that lead, but he did make that comment. He said, you know, nobody ever got fired. And right behind the election came the economy, and we don't talk about that. They were dead wrong on the economy, even worse than the election.
Yeah,
there were some outlier polls.
It's going to be a stock market crash and all this. Paul Krugman made a fool of himself as well, as usual. William, I mean, what we got was 2 years of an echo chamber, and we were told what I think was essentially a propaganda, but they will survive this, or will they? Because more and more people go to online programming, they go to podcasts right now because their credibility has been shot. And from what the few days after the report was made public, or parts of it was made public, they've just doubled and tripled down. What does this tell you? Is that there's no learning curve here? They're ideologically possessed. They're unable to have self-reflection, because I think that, you know, they haven't gotten over Trump's victory, and they've never had a inward-looking moment, an autopsy of their behavior, and they continue to make the same mistakes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, for example, when I came out pointing to the forensics, the factual evidence and the forensics of it, they called me a conspiracy theorist. You know, it was like I was going against the narrative, and so therefore, you know, they couldn't admit that in public, so they had to deny it in one way or the other. So they labeled me as a conspiracy, an ad hominem attack. But the point is that they did not want to accept anything except the narrative they were pushing. And several reasons for that. I mean, you know, after a while, you have to realize you're going to have to eat crow for the mistakes you've been making. Now, how can you avoid that? You try to avoid the shame by diverting attention in other directions, by trying to focus on something else. But in the end, that crow only gets bigger, and you got to eat more crow in the end. And so I call these people mentally impaired by their emotions. They have lost any objectivity and
let me offer a dissenting.
Go ahead, Alan. Jump in. Go ahead.
Let me offer a dissenting view on this. I don't think it's as much about ideology as it is about money. I think that CNN looked at Fox and said Fox is making a fortune, is doing much better than we are because they're presenting a narrative, although it's a much more nuanced narrative. If we want to make money and sell soap, the best thing we can do is present completely one-sided. So if you're anti-Trump, turn to CNN. You'll get it all day, 24/7. That is a business decision that has been made, and it tells you what's going on in this country.
But it's also
where
a business
we divide.
Decision by
it's
my
like,
dad.
You know, rooting
it's
for a, the New York Yankees or the Boston Red Sox.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, I'm saying you don't want a channel in baseball.
Hang on, William. Let Alan finish.
The Red Sox and the Yankees.
Okay, go ahead and jump in, William. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm just saying.
Okay, there's also another aspect to this. If they can create this Russiagate to the point where we can create a new Cold War, that means trillions of dollars. You're absolutely right. Money is a driver behind a lot of this.
Okay, let me go back to Alan.
Mental impairment
I agree. I think both are true. But let me go back to Alan in Miami. Do you find it really disturbing that you have former heads of the intelligence services as talking heads on CNN and MSNBC? Because it seems like a marriage of the intelligence community and the media. Because it's very obvious to me that they were getting their talking point. Or it's actually, I don't know where they got their talking points, but it's certainly a circular environment, okay, where you leak something to the media, and the media ask you about it, and you confirm it. I mean, again, going back to the weapons of mass destruction in 2000, prior to 2003 here, I find it very unhealthy that the media has actually injected these type of people into their opinion forums. Go ahead, Alan.
Look, there are some that are better, there's some that are worse. What worries me is when you have the former head of the CIA expressing views the viewer thinks he must know more than they do because he has access or had access to the deepest of our intelligence. The same thing was true with Comey when he wrote his book. He just left the FBI. You don't write a book when you just left the FBI or the CIA and use material that you learned in a confidential way. It also misleads the viewer and the listener into thinking that their expertise should give them more credibility. Well, we now learn from Brennan, well, he was given bad information. And he gave the American public very bad conclusions. I like Brennan. I think he's a nice guy. I met him when he was the director of the CIA. But I do think he would have been better off remaining silent for at least 5 years after he finished his job in the Obama CIA. And I think the same thing is true with Comey. Silence can be golden when you've had access to major, major secrets, and then you use that access to present an expertise that either isn't there, or if it's there, you shouldn't be sharing it with the American public because it's based on classified material.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go back to Doug in Washington. We're told that they're going to continue. We have congressional committees under the gavel of the Democrats. They're going to continue these investigations here. Do you think people are going to give them much credibility after this nothing burger that was served up to the public here with such high expectations? I mean, I watch clip after clip, you know, person after person on CNN and MSNBC saying that there's going to be indictments. Indictments, okay? And they're all going to go back to work. They're probably at work right now, and they're going to start on these new investigations. Is it going to cut? Will it cut much mustard with the public, Doug?
I don't think it will. I'm surprised the way things are falling into place for Donald Trump. But I think that's why Nancy Pelosi is kind of pulling her punches right now for fear it won't. To me, the most egregious moment is when the president of the United States is at a summit talking with a North Korean communist leader who threatened Japan, Australia, which many people don't pay any attention to, and the United States with nuclear weapons. And here's the national media with a split screen showing a man who had been convicted of perjury testifying again against Trump. To me, that, I mean, you're putting at risk your country, your children, your people, nuclear war. Well, you're sending the signal to Kim Jong-un, we're on your side, buddy, just cool it. You'll get what you want if you just play it cool. I felt that was horrendous to
me. Well, you know, I agree with both of you, with you and Alan. It certainly is about money. That's always first and foremost here. But let me go to William here. They would rather see this president fail in foreign policy endeavors. They would rather see him fail even if it hurts the country. I mean, this is what we've gotten to. This is what this media has done. Go ahead, William.
Yeah, that's basically what happened with the Helsinki conference that President Trump had with Putin, President Putin. I mean, that's when Rosenstein came out with his indictment the Friday before, just before the weekend conference they had. It was the same issue. It was well-timed to divert the attention away from any foreign policy that he was trying to develop. So, and Rosenstein put out a document that claimed a lot of things, but produced evidence that was not from NSA or documented, or didn't, nor did he have control of the evidence. It came from, I'm sure, CrowdStrike, a third party, someone who had access to the DNC servers. That to me, said that this is not admissible evidence in a court of law because they could not show continuous control of the evidence.
Okay, gentlemen, I'm sure there are a lot more.
But still, they used it to divert.
But they still used it here, and I really hope that we'll do an episode on just what happened with the defrauding of that FISA court and, of course, the dossier. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Miami. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR. Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.